Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Lives Less Ordinary is the podcast from the BBC World Service, bringing you extraordinary personal stories from around the globe. Search for Lives Less Ordinary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hi, I'm Daniel Dazzi, and here's what's coming up for you on this edition of Focus on Africa. People born in the Chagos Islands say their new passports fail to list their place of birth on the archipelago. And we find out more about the musical feud or rivalry between two heavyweights on the Afrobeat stage, Wizkid and Davido.
Wizkid and Davido, they've always had a bit of a tension between them, but their relationship has been a spectrum of some sort.
But first, let's return to the East African region. Now, over the last few days, we've been keeping track of the floods in that region. So far, we know that about 400 people have been killed and over 200,000 people have been displaced after weeks of torrential rains. To make matters worse, Cyclone Hidaya struck on Saturday. Three people were reported to have been killed following the landfall, and more than 100 others were rescued in Tanzania and neighbouring Kenya. I had a chat with Alfred Lastic, who's been following events from Dar es Salaam. Alfred, thanks a lot. You've been busy, especially over the weekend, and we spoke to you ahead of the cyclone making landfall. Slightly good news, it weakened. But what was the impact?
The impact was, you know, reported that three people had died in different spots in Tanzania, and a lot of infrastructure damaged, along with properties destroyed in many parts of the south of Tanzania, some kilometers away from the commercial city of Dar es Salaam.
Now, the World Meteorological Organization had warned ahead of the cyclone that these torrential rains would worsen the humanitarian crisis. What would that crisis look like?
Yeah, of course, when such incidents and such weather patterns come on board, normally there's a lot of challenges that come across, you know, and most of the time people have been criticizing the government on, you know, the preparedness ahead of some predicted disasters. So sometimes the government is blamed for not having the best measures ahead and even when the crisis comes on.
Does it look like there's anything different this time around? Is the government prepared enough for something in the future?
Yeah, it looks like the government was prepared. It has been given information about, you know, the situation. And it feels like it's a major step, you know, approaching these disasters when they come. Compared to some years back where, you know, the government will lately deploy to a place where there is something that is, affecting people. But this time, the government has been very supportive because we even had talked with the authorities as they are giving us updates on what is going on, how they are taking measures, the measures on how to tackle this challenge. And they even gave us a post report of what happened.
I also caught up with our senior Africa correspondent, Ansoy, for a wider look. She began by bringing me up to date.
We understand from the Ministry of Interior in Kenya that so far more than 228 people have died from the floods that we've witnessed recently here in Kenya. I can't remember witnessing that amount of flooding in my lifetime. And so that just gives you a sense of how unusual this weather has been. It has been very difficult. Tens of thousands of people have been displaced here in the country, and in other places, actually, they have been evacuated or forced to evacuate because some of the houses have been built on riparian areas, and because of the flooding, it means that, you know, the water is coming to reclaim some of its former areas that it was occupying. You know, the levels had gone down, and therefore people were able to put up houses very close to waterways, including rivers. And now they have been ordered, you know, to evacuate for their own safety. And so you have people who have been displaced, you know, and you're leaving your home there, and it is likely to be swept away. You're not likely to recover. There's the climate center that has been observing all these changes for the what they call the Greater Horn of Africa region. And they're saying that, you know, some of these anomalies are like very rare events. But they're also warning that because of climate change, we are likely to experience such extreme weather more frequently. As you remember, the Horn of Africa in the past few years was experiencing repeated cycles of suppressed rain or drought. In some areas, they had not seen rain for five subsequent seasons. And then finally, there is rain, but it is too devastating to lead to a recovery. It is just more devastation, more death, more animals being swept away. The farms are inundated, and therefore they're not as productive as you would imagine when it rains. Mm. So, and all this is pointing towards the effect of climate change.
What sense are you getting about a coordinated response to this crisis that has been predicted by the IGAD office?
IGAD Climate Center actually made this prediction in February, but I think many people did not pay enough attention to it, and therefore when they have been hit, what we saw is that initially, in the initial days of the heavy rains and the flooding, is that governments were not as quick to act, and therefore people were left to their own devices. Not enough information was put out there, not enough advisories were issued by governments, and therefore you saw people making really daring moves, some of which claimed their lives. But then once that information became available, then we're seeing slowly by slowly more people taking action, including international organizations that have now come together to try and help people. I've been seeing, for instance, the Kenya Wildlife Service that has mobilized its air transport, its helicopters to rescue people who are, you know, stuck, marooned by water. And therefore, the only way to get them to safety is by helicopters. We have seen the World Food Program is helping to deliver food, to provide food for those people who have been displaced by the flood. So slowly by slowly, there is more and more effort from international organizations. And, you know, you have local organizations, international organizations like the Red Cross that have also been really at the forefront of dealing with this challenge, not just in Kenya, but, you know, across the region. You know, we're talking about a very large area. Just looking at some of the amounts of rains that had been predicted over the past week by the IGAD Climate Center, you know, they're expecting more than 200 millimeters of rain in parts of central and western Kenya, southern and eastern Ethiopia, and central and northwestern Somalia. And these are large areas that are already having challenges of their own, that have been dealing with challenges, different challenges. And then suddenly there's this rain that, you know, brings everything to a standstill. Right. And there were real fears going into the weekend that has just passed about the cyclone that was expected to hit the East African coast. And I think people are breathing a sigh of relief now that it wasn't more devastating.
Right. Let's talk a bit about the humanitarian situation. And you allude to that this is a region that has a lot of challenges of its own. In fact, I was chatting with Alfred Lastek earlier, and we're talking about how the World Meteorological Organization had warned that there could be a worsened humanitarian crisis as a result of Cyclone Hidaya. Tell me what it's like in these IDP camps and with these people who already had so many challenges.
Well, you know, people were minding their business, you know, going about their daily lives, and then suddenly they are displaced. And, you know, you even saw some of the refugee camps that were submerged. So, you know, when nature unleashes its wrath, it doesn't spare anyone. And so it has been a very difficult time for people. But then, well, some people have been rescued, some people have been able to move to higher ground. There are warnings also about what this could portend.
Finally, Anne, do you get the sense that people are satisfied with government's response to this disaster? And do you get the sense that people are confident that enough preparation has been made for if the situation gets worse this week and possibly beyond?
Far from it. People have been very critical of the government's response, particularly here in Kenya, where it's been the impact has been felt quite a bit, not just in rural areas like Maima Hill in the west of Nairobi, but also in the capital where homes have been inundated. They felt that the government could have reacted faster. They felt that, you know, the information could have, the warnings, the predictions could have been made more seriously and the information spread to more people to prepare. But even the actions that were taken after that, people felt they were too little, too late. However, people are just trying to get by with the situation, but they do not feel that enough has been done to assure them that the water that they are consuming now has not been contaminated. There have been warnings that we could have outbreaks of disease like cholera and the like. And people are asking, so can we have vaccines and, you know, things to prepare us in case we have these eventualities?
And that's the BBC's Anne Soy. Last week, Kenya's president, William Ruto, told Focus on Africa that the government had done the best they could given the circumstances and more needed to be done. Well, today the BBC heard from the Tanzanian government spokesperson, Mubari Matinyi.
Frankly speaking, this is almost a natural disaster. It's not normal for this kind of torrential rain to happen. So we haven't lost many people because we had prepared, we had informed the people as well. The infrastructure severely damaged, some schools, some residential houses. But we have our people working there to make sure everything gets normal. This is related to El Nino, the heating up of the waters in the Pacific Oceans far from Africa. This is where the whole thing started. And it can happen again next year or after a few years to come. The only thing we have to do is to get more prepared.
Tanzanian government spokesperson Mubari Matinyi. Our next story arises out of a great big geopolitical story and the messy overhang of colonialism. It goes back to 1965, when the people of the Chagos Islands off the coast of Africa were told they would be forcibly resettled in Mauritius and the Seychelles. Their homeland had been claimed for use by the British and the US, who wanted it for a military base that is still in use today. It was originally part of the colonial territory of Mauritius, but when Mauritius became independent, the Chagos Islands remained under British rule. Years of fighting to get their land back led to a ruling at the International Court of Justice that, and I quote, "The UK is under an obligation to bring to an end its administration of the Chagos Archipelago as rapidly as possible." The UN General Assembly voted by an overwhelming majority that the UK is to withdraw from the Chagos Islands. Recently, the latest Foreign Minister David Cameron says the UK will not return possession of the islands. Now, many of those who were removed in the late 60s and early 70s have died, but those who are alive remember how even their pet dogs were destroyed by gassing, poisoning and shooting to empty the island of Chagosians. Today, the people of the Chagos Islands face the total erasure of their link to their homeland. Their parents' names and their place of birth is no longer reflected on official documents. My colleague Richard Kagoi heard all about it in a conversation with someone who left the main island of Diego Garcia as a toddler.
My name is Bernadette Jigas. I come out of a family of eight, three brothers and five sisters. I was born on Diego Garcia without a birth certificate, deported and dumped in the Seychelles with my mom and father and a brother. It was not easy during that time in the Seychelles without a birth certificate, but my parents managed. I've got my birth certificate after I was married. During that time, I was working with an English guy. He told me to go to Mauritius, and I told him I can't because I don't have a birth certificate. He said, "How come?" And I say, "I don't have it because I was not born in the Seychelles." And I say, "I was born on Diego Garcia." Then he said, "Okay, I'm going to talk to the British High Commissioner in the Seychelles," which he did after 3 days, I've got my first British passport in 1980. We were not allowed to have a British passport. But as I didn't have any document in the Seychelles, I needed that passport to go to Mauritius for a second opinion about my health. When I went to Mauritius, I went for a checkup. Then I went for my birth certificate, which I obtained. I didn't get the original one, a colonial one. I get an independence of Mauritius one. On my way back to the Seychelles, I was told by the immigration people that I'm a foreigner in the Seychelles. I was working and I was not able to work. There was a stamp in my passport. So I had to seek help. Then I was given a Seychelles passport through my grandfather, my dad's father. And my birth certificate stated that I was born in Diego Garcia. Every time I renew my British passport or Seychelles passport, it was stated Diego Garcia. From the Seychelles one, it was stated born on Diego Garcia, Mauritius. Suddenly, I don't know what happened. I didn't check that my status was removed. How can I be a Mauritian? I've been in touch with the president, Seychelles president, no response. I've been in touch with the immigration officers in the Seychelles, no response. But the Seychelles High Commissioner in the UK, I had good response with her. The immigration officers told the Seychelles High Commissioner that they remove it because they are using regional status.
Did they explain to you why your birthplace was removed?
Nobody came forward to explain to me. If the president wanted to do that, or the immigration officer in the Seychelles wanted to do that, there's a committee in the Seychelles. Why not contact the committee, the Sagosian committee in the Seychelles, and explain to them? Not just surprise us with that.
And so how does that make you feel about your birthplace, you know, being a country where you weren't actually born in? What does that really do to your psyche and your identity?
I don't have an identity anymore. If I'm going around with two passports, one I'm born on Diego Garcia, one born on Mauritius, it's a fraud. To me, I'm a fraud. How can a people be born on two different places? I don't know. I'm confused. Who am I? I don't consider me as a Mauritian or Seychellois because I am a Sagosian, born in the Sagos Island.
Where do you consider to be home? Is it the Seychelles? Is it the Seychelles Islands? Is it Mauritius? Which is home now for you?
I grew up in the Seychelles. I don't feel a Seychellois. Even I have siblings born in the Seychelles. I don't feel one of them. I don't feel I am a Mauritian because I don't have any affiliation with Mauritius. When I went to Seychelles first time, when I was 55 years old, I felt that I belong there.
You visited there for the first time in so many years, and I guess probably you didn't even have any memory about the Seychelles Islands. What was the experience like for you?
Well, I was hoping that we will land during daytime so I can explore it a bit. But sadly, we landed at night, completely dark. And the next day, when I hear the magpie robin singing, the birds are praying early morning, wakes you up. I was overjoyed, over sad. I have a mixed feeling. I don't know if I wanted to cry or shout. I don't know. But I had that feeling that this is home to me. This is where I belong.
You know, the ownership of the islands has been quite disputed. I'll just take you back to 2022. We had Mauritius formally challenging Britain's ownership of the islands. That's after the International Courts of Justice ruled that the UK had acted unlawfully in retaining colonial ownership in 1965 as part of Mauritius' independence agreement. So who, in your opinion, should own the Seychelles Islands?
Seychelles Island doesn't belong to the British. It doesn't belong to the Mauritian. Seychelles belong to us, Sagosian, We are the belongers of Diego Garcia, Peros Banos and Salomon and all the other islands. How far is Britain to Diego Garcia? How far is Mauritius to Sagos? Mauritius sold his rights to the British to gain independence. And at that time, he sold us Sagosian as well. After you sold your car to me, and then after 50 years, you wanted your car back. Is there justice in it? What happened to us? We are always in the middle, getting pull right, pull left, pull center. I think it's time to give us back what's belonged to us. Let us go home. Everybody has a place called home. We know that Chagos is our home. Please, let us go home.
In January this year, the UK's Foreign Secretary ruled out any plans of resettlement.
When we ask him question about that, all of them, they don't answer us. They just ignore our question. The fight will continue until one day we will fulfill our dream. We move to the UK to be closer whenever there's a court hearing. We obtain a British passport. We move to the UK. Nothing prepared for us. Till now, I don't have a house in the UK. I'm still fighting to get a council house. I'm 67, pension age. I don't have a pension from the British government. I am told that because I didn't work, which I did voluntary work for my community. They don't consider this as a job. To me, it was something because I was going back and forth with people to the council, accompanied them, talk to the doctor on their behalf. I don't get anything. We are still struggling. When will it end? Why didn't the British government, instead of deporting us and dumping in the Seychelles and Mauritius, why didn't they gas us like they gas our pet dog?
So you're still keeping the faith and you're very hopeful that one day you will be resettled.
And my children and my grandchildren or great-grandchildren will one day settle there.
Bernadette Dugas, born on the island of Diego Garcia in the Chagos Islands. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service.
Chasing Mountains is the story of five incredible mountaineers competing to become the first woman to climb all 14 of the world's highest mountain peaks, the so-called 8,000ers.
Pitting themselves against nature on the roof of the world.
Amazing sports stories from the BBC World Service. Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Now, like most people, the first thing I do when I wake up is pick up my phone and check out what's trending on social media. And for weeks, the topic around most of the world has been beef. Not the dish. The feud or rivalry between musicians. First, there's hip-hop stars Drake and Kendrick Lamar, who've been firing songs at each other for nearly a month. And closer to home, Nigerian musicians Wizkid and Davido, whose long-standing feud reignited recently. They've spun a web of drama that would make a Nollywood blockbuster. But what is behind these very public clashes? Are they even real or just carefully crafted publicity stunts? Well, my colleague Richard Kagoi spoke to journalist and host of the Afrobeats Intelligence podcast, Joey Akan, to find out more.
Hey, Joey Akan, great having you on Focus on Africa podcast. How are you doing?
I'm good, Richard. Thanks for having me on the Focus on Africa podcast. How's that going?
No, I'm keeping well. Really appreciate your time. Yeah, lots of developments in the Afrobeats space. So first things first, what's going on between Davido and Wizkid? I hear there's a feud. How did it start?
Well, this one was unprovoked. Wizkid and Davido, they've always had a bit of a tension between them. But their relationship has been a spectrum of some sort. Peers and colleagues, and then at some point, they both rose to the top of the game, stayed there for a while, pushing each other artistically and raising the ceiling and even the base floor for the entire industry and Afrobeats in its formative stages. But over time, as is always the case, you have two people with professional respect for each other become some sort of rivalry, and you know, there's now some bad blood as recent as 2022? Yeah, 2 years ago. They had a little makeup. Everybody hugged each other. It was public. They even performed together on the Pepsi show.
December, just in December last year, they spent time together at the party together. So, but this one was unprovoked. Wizkid just took a pot shot at him by raising a video that showed Davido in a vulnerable light. And yeah, Davido took the bait, and now we have a free for all.
You know, because you've talked about their relationship sort of like blowing hot and cold. So, and there have been these moments where they've been able to make up. So that inconsistency in that relationship, I wonder how that impacts the Afrobeat space in general.
There are pros and cons to it. I'm not going to lie. As a business person, it's been great. They've pushed each other professionally, each responding to the other's projects with new levels of success. And by doing that, they sort of inspired and lifted the entire industry. That's what they did for years before Burna Boy hit his current levels. So it's a good thing that they've, in that sense, in that from that perspective, it's a good thing that they've hit that level and they've done that. It's part of their career shifting work. But there's always the basic human, you know, decency to say, hey, people shouldn't fight. Enmity isn't good. And even if you're professional, your professional rivals, at least try to maintain a healthy personal relationship. At least maybe you might not be friends, but be polite to each other, you know. But yeah, so that's been the good part and the bad part. Now it appears to be a tough war now because everyone's coming out with their own version of it and their own contributions to it. But I like to think of it as a net win for the system.
Has this impacted their fans in any way? Has it sort of like stoked any divisions? What are they saying online?
Fandom in itself is just a difference in opinion, you know, peculiarity that's just based on your music taste. So it shouldn't be that deep. But somehow people find ways to make it a part of their identity. They build altars and serve these people up as idols to worship. And yeah, so it's that deep now. Any sign of opposition, any antagonization on any level, they respond to it from a very neurotic place. And so that's why it's now a topic in our industry conversation now, like fandom levels, fandom depth, and unfortunately, fandom riots. I don't know what to call it. I don't want to be derogatory here. So yeah, so it's caused that. There are groups now, mm-hmm. There are factions, both within the civilian population and within the industry. Everyone's taking sides and just trying to make sense of it all.
Would you say we'll be reading too much into this? Because it seems like it's a natural sort of like a consequence, especially when you're having two people who are prominent and they're making moves and, you know, there's some level of competition. And I know at some point even ego checks in. So would we be reading too much into this?
I don't think we are. We are. There have been multiple instances where things like this have been known to become more violent or perhaps fatal. It's all there in music history. While I like the healthy competition angle online, I like people going against each other as long as it's healthy and within the rules. But all right. When it goes below the belt, that's when, you know, there's a bit of a question mark there. So we're not reading too much into it. It's parts of it, some of it is great, but a lot of it has been very sordid.
I don't know whether to call this a coincidence, because as all this is happening, the parallels with what's going on between Drake and Kendrick. Is there a common thread between this?
Mad. We've all gone mad. I think the world's gone mad. I think the world's gone mad. As usual, you could see the same narrative or the same parallels. You could draw them across both industries. And that's to show you the very nature of humanity. Competition has to happen. That's how advancement works. Look at the way of the world. But I like to keep it healthy, and that's what I just hope all of this stays at. A healthy place. Throw your this thing. Make great music. Push yourselves to new heights. And by doing so, elevate the entire conversation and the space.
Yeah, it's important, especially for safeguarding your reputation and your brand and how people perceive you out there. Now that exactly. We're seeing lots of these arguments, you know, taking place within the social media space, do you think this has any impact on the artists, you know, reputation and their brand? And I wonder what their teams would be doing in terms of interventions.
No. Make it sound like there's negativity here. For both of them, it's good for their brands. We spent an entire week. Look at the BBC is doing a piece now on their on their beef. How is it not good?
Yeah.
So any publicity is good publicity.
This has added to their legend. So everyone's looking forward to what they want to release next. And they'll have to compare them again. And so this has just opened up a new frontier for their story. And it's propelling them forward. If Whiskey drops now, I want to go and listen to it because I want to see if Davido does the same thing. I want to go listen. Yeah, you got to come correct. So somehow this is heightened anticipation for their next piece. So it's good for them. I thoroughly enjoy the blowback on them. It's great for everyone.
So what you're saying, Joey, here, there's no downside to this.
There's a capitalist side, like I told you about. Like it profits everyone in terms of advancements. But I just wanted to stay within the rules.
Oh, you're so modest, Joey. But thank you so much. Really been great chatting with you here on the podcast.
Thank you so much. Thank you. It's been fun too.
And that was journalist and host of the Afrobeat Intelligence podcast, Joey Akan. Thanks for listening. This episode of Focus on Africa was produced by Charles Gitonga, Bella Hassan and Audrey Brown, supervised by Connie Sharp. Technical producer is Philip Bull. Editors are Alice Muthengi and Andre Lombard. I'm Daniel Dazzi. Have a great week.
Chasing Mountains is the story of five incredible mountaineers competing to become the first woman to climb all 14 of the world's highest mountain peaks, the so-called 8,000ers,
pitting themselves against nature on the roof of the world.
Amazing sports stories from the BBC World Service. Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.